Y'all, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Matthew Iglesias is a well-known liberal politics and policy writer. In a recent viral column for The Argument, he made a pretty controversial claim that some of the most popular progressive ideas of the last decade weren't just an update to liberalism, they were a break from it, a fox that snuck into the henhouse. This episode comes out of a question that's been hanging over a lot of liberal institutions, from newsrooms and universities to nonprofits and democratic politics. How did we get from a broadly liberal consensus about individual rights and equal treatment to a period where it became normal to talk about people primarily as members of groups and to treat neutral rules with suspicion? That question is awkward because it sounds like an internal fight at exactly the moment that the external threat of authoritarianism feels obvious. But it's also the kind of question that liberals can't continue to dodge, because the way we answer it shapes what kind of alternative we can offer in future elections and what kind of society we're trying to build. This isn't an episode about cancel culture, and it's not a therapy session about 2017. It is a conversation about what liberalism actually is, what it asks of us morally, what it assumes about people, and what happens when you stop believing in its basic premise that individuals aren't reducible to the averages of their group, even when those averages are real. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together everyone from socialists to conservatives in conversation over the most important issues of the day. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Matt Iglesias, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Actually, you've been on the show before. You are our first episode of our live podcast. So this is the first time
in
studio.
In the studio.
This is real. So I wanted to start with a article that you wrote for us called The Fox in Liberalism's Hen House.
Yeah.
And it resulted out of like a bunch of conversations that you had and like we had in the office and about what went wrong with modern liberalism. And I'm hoping you can just situate, what is the argument? What went wrong?
Yeah, I mean, so many things. No, so, you know, one thing that you know, right now I've been looking at these stories about like these welfare fraud situations in Minneapolis, which like it seems like it's bad. People shouldn't steal money from public sector programs. And then at the same time, you have like huge swaths of the conservative movement are like, so we need to do ethnic cleansing of Somalians. And I think everybody who is left of center like understands why that is wrong, right? That you do not want to attribute to whole groups of people on the basis of their identity, like crimes that were committed by individuals. And that even if you can say like statistically, Somali immigrants were more likely to be involved in this, it's still as an individual person, you have either done the crime or you haven't. And if you haven't, you haven't,
yeah.
Right? And that's like the primacy of the individual. But 10 years ago, when it felt like the wind was at the backs of progressives and that, you know, the arc of history was blowing in our side, I think there was a lot of collectivist identity, racial and ethnic thinking was being imported into left of center circles as if the natural like next step forward from like racism is bad was to what we should be judging everybody on the basis of these group attributions. And because it was presented with a kind of progressive rhetoric, because it was presented as conceptually like linked to an earlier generation of anti-racist struggles, or particularly the gay rights movement, which had really sort of flourished in the immediate path, a lot of, you know, center-left progressive liberals just kind of took it on board. And when the script flips and like the tide starts to go out, I think it becomes very clear to everybody like how deeply illiberal this kind of thing is. And like, I don't think that the people who had like you know, like white male tears mugs and stuff necessarily meant that seriously, quote unquote, or like that it's the same mm-hmm. as what Stephen Miller is doing. But it is the same, like on another
in what way?
Level. I mean, it's just like saying, like, I have decided that, like, there's some statistical average property of this group of people mm-hmm. that I don't like. And so I'm going to express broad brush negativity about all of them in, like, a whatever way. Mm-hmm. And then if somebody is like, well, that, you know, makes me sad, you're mm-hmm. like, oh, fuck you. Like, I don't care. Right. Yeah. And it's like, it's actually bad. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, something that I think we're going to have to do to, like, rebuild liberalism is to take it seriously in both directions, mm-hmm. right? That like the primacy of the individual really counts for something, that like being biased against people on the basis of their identity is bad mm-hmm. and wrong, but that like for that exact same reason, you want to treat people as individuals. There was like this whole period of time when it was like considered the most right-wing thing in the world to like quote Martin Luther King on the importance of judging people by the content of their character. And like, I agree that there was something a little bad faith, a little opportunistic about the way Republicans would invoke that idea. Mm-hmm. But what was bad faith and opportunistic about it is that they weren't taking yeah. seriously yeah. that like that is a real idea that conservatives frequently contest. Mm-hmm. And that like, just champion for like real reasons.
So I want to start like at a very basic level yeah. here. Why is it that using group statistical averages to make judgments about individuals is wrong? Because I think this is an argument that I think a lot of people on the right, or like maybe what refer themselves to sometimes as reactionary centrists, will say. It was just like, listen, like obviously you shouldn't just like berate people or like beat them up or whatever in public, but it's fine to observe that like Somali immigrants are more likely to have participated in this scandal, and therefore we should have a difference of perspective on whether or not we should allow Somali immigrants into this country relative to other immigrants who may be less likely. Not that we're blaming any individual, but we're making choices in an environment where we have limited information. So what's wrong with that?
Right. I mean, I do think that like, you have to have some nuance in your perspective about this, because you don't want to say that like nobody should be allowed to say something that is statistically true mm-hmm. just because it's sort of inconvenient or something like that. At the same time, like I think that we have a lot of experience of societies tearing themselves apart over these kinds of things, and that people, you know, quite rightly feel that like they deserve to not be discriminated against, even if the discrimination is being done on the basis of some kind of statistically valid generalization. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know like in the sort of economics literature, right? Like there used to be this distinction that people would draw between taste-based discrimination, mm-hmm. where it's like, just like, I don't like black people, and statistical discrimination, where you're saying, you know, like, the classic is like the cab driver, mm-hmm. right? Who's like, well, this person is probably going to want me to go to some out of the way, low income neighborhood where I'm not getting another fare. So,
or they might not tip me, or they might.
Yeah. But like yeah. the tip thing is like a negative value judgment. But I mean, just like facts about the world.
Yeah.
Right. And so you might say, look, like even a black cab driver would mm-hmm. engage in that kind of practice sometime, because it's like true that yes. in Washington, D.C., African-Americans are poorer. They live in neighborhoods that are worse for picking up fares, et cetera. People don't want to live in a world where that happens to them.
Yeah.
And like, I think that when it is flipped around, everybody sees that, mm-hmm. right? And there's like a little bit of like golden rule to it, you know, that like it's very easy but lazy for white people to just be like, well, we're the majority, mm-hmm. so we can just do it to other people and like it'll be fine. Or then on the progressive side, to be like, well, you know, like we're gonna like champion the interests of oppressed people, but like we don't care about the people who are at the top of the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. But everybody cares a lot when it happens to them. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's really hurtful and it sucks
yeah.
to have like negativity placed on you for things that you didn't do.
I think that's like the fundamental answer, but I also think there's like another layer here, which is that people often overrate the degree to which these small differences in likelihood actually are relevant in their determinations about what will make
what they should think about a person. So, I mean, I think a simple way is like, if you were to say like, wow, like Somali immigrants relative to the population are more likely to have participated in the recent Minneapolis scandal. You were like describing a true fact about the world, but it's one of those things where it's like, you would probably make a bunch of category errors if you were like to observe, if to go up to random Somali people and assume that it's likely that they are participants in like fraud or scandals, because still the rate of people who participate in these sorts of things is so low. I mean, we know this in a couple, I mean, from a like progressive direction, this always happens obviously from, you know, maybe it is the case, it is obviously the case that Black people are overrepresented in people who are committing crimes, in committing violent crimes. But at the same time, the vast, vast majority of Black people do not commit violent crimes. And so it's kind of like a ridiculous way to even engage in like an empirical exercise.
I mean, yes, I just like, I don't like to go like too down the rabbit hole of like disputing the math, because I do think that like a very common conservative take on this is to just like pound the facts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there like is a morality problem, right?
That
like,
no, I agree. I think,
it's just like, it's very common, I think actually, but particularly, you know, with race and crime linkage, right? For conservatives to, instead of trying to find policies that reduce crime, to just sort of say that like through segregation, de facto or de jure, we're going to like insulate ourselves.
But I think the conservatives begin to understand this problem when it got turned on them, when it became a situation where it's like, oh, well, men are statistically more likely to commit crimes than like any other, like young men are like overwhelmingly the people who are committing these crimes. And so therefore, it's completely reasonable to treat men as if they are like these horrible beings who are going to just commit assault and like immediately becomes clear that like why you don't want to behave this way.
And that's like hashtag not all men, right? But yes, and like again, like it is true that like the overwhelming majority of sexual assault is committed by men, and also the overwhelming majority of men are not committing sexual assaults, right? And that these are both things.
But I think it's actually like I actually want to linger here because like, I actually think that that's. People who think about statistics all the time think this is like a trivial point to make.
Sure.
But like often when we are communicating things to the general public who do not use statistics in their normal life or in their work, they hear something like Black people are more likely to commit crimes or men are more likely to commit sexual assault. And they begin to think that means majority or at least very, very large proportion of people.
Well, sure. And getting the math right is important in these contexts. I mean, again, where sort of, I think the left started going off the rails on some of this is that there would be a lot of observation that African-Americans are overrepresented in the prison population, right? Which was then taken to mean that like reducing the prison population sort of by any means necessary would be advantageous to African-Americans. But of course, like most Black people were not in prison under any circumstances. And for all the same reasons, Black people were disproportionately impacted by crime.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And so that's not to say that like any given prison sentence is or is not correct or deployment of police or whatever else. But like you have to actually ask the question, like, what does this policy do?
Yeah.
Right. Like what's actually happening here and who's benefiting? And that there was this, you know, this tendency to like look at representativeness and then it just kind of allied the question of like who specifically is damaged by this policy and who benefits, do the costs exceed the benefits. I was reminded also during when the COVID vaccines were new and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices said, well, if we give vaccines to the elderly in strict priority, the elderly population is disproportionately white. So this would be like bad for racial equity. And so we need to have this like other distribution. But if you try to like look under the hood, right, like Black senior citizens were going to be deprioritized for vaccination in favor of younger people and put their own lives at risk too, right? Like people have something in common with other people who are in the same ethnic group as they do. I feel some kinship with other Jewish Americans, with other Cuban Americans, et cetera. But we're not like literally linked by like a metaphysical chain of command, right? If you don't give me a vaccine and you give it to somebody else who's in some ethnic group, like I don't derive benefit from that, right?
Well,
and it's, you know, all kinds of things like wealth gap statistics, income gap statistics. If you take people who are poor and you make those people richer, you benefit them. If you give economic resources to someone who's not me, but who has my, like, I don't derive like mysterious racial benefit from Mark Zuckerberg having $1 billion, right? Like, that's not how the world works. Or at least I don't think it's a liberal way of thinking about the world, right? Like, you know, so these things, like, they're real. It's important to make some observations about how disparities work, you know, in all kinds of different directions. We do want to understand what the statistical properties of the American population are. But we got into a space of wildly over-indexing on that stuff, completely ignoring, like, all the work that had been done to sort of discredit it in the past, or the risk that just, like, stereotyping would come back in a big way. And that's what we really see now, right? Like, on Muskified Twitter every day, it's like we're back in the early 1980s, where, like, you're not supposed to say, like, racism is good, but it's just, like, carte blanche to engage in all kinds of negative stereotyping of people and then defend yourself by saying, well, but I'm being accurate, right? And, like, that's a real regress from, like, where we were 20 to 25 years ago as a society. But it is something that, like, in my experience, you know, 15 years ago, left-wing people were really the ones who were, like, eager to push down these norms of individualism and colorblindness.
So I want to get into, like, the causality here, because I think that, like, a lot of people can hear the example that you give, which also you give in the article about vaccine prioritization, not going towards who's more like, most likely to die, but trying to at least, in some ways, redress group inequality, and in which case the impact of that would be that more people might die because they're less likely to give the vaccine to the elderly. And then there's another example you give around, schools no longer tracking in advanced math or things like that. I want you to walk us through how you go from there are these kind of obscure elite books like CRT, critical race theory, or books or, you know, this, you cite this Roosevelt Institute report, which is like pretty, I'm sure like, maybe under 1,000 people read that report. Like, maybe you read it 1,000 times and, like, nobody else read it. Like, I just don't think it's like, how do you get from those to these impacts? I think that, like, a lot of people don't really get the causal chain.
So, I mean, my, you know, lived experience of this, so to speak, is, you know, sometime early in the, like, Facebook viral content era, we started to see that there was, like, a lot of internet traffic interest in kind of, like, you know, pieces that would be like, ah, this old sitcom that you like is really problematic. You know, this kind of like soft social justice content that wasn't like tackling big issues, but was just kind of like calling stuff problematic in different kinds of ways. And a lot of people who were a little bit younger than me who were coming into digital media were doing those kind of pieces as sort of entry level work instead of doing traditional entry level reporting type stuff. And they were using a lot of lingo and concepts that were not super familiar to me, ideas about microaggressions and systemic racism and so on and so forth. And I feel like it like sounds silly from the standpoint of 2025 to say like, I didn't really know what people meant by systemic racism when I started hearing it in 2011 or something. But like, honestly, I didn't. I'm like a well-educated person who's like conversant in politics and policy. And that was not a concept that was like, in the Harvard philosophy department. It's not a concept that William Julius Wilson was really using when I heard him lecture. These were coming from a different space, but people learned about them in college. They started deploying them in very sort of casual contexts in internet articles. I think a lot of people my age or a little bit older were kind of befuddled by the popularity of some of this content. This is what people want to read. We were a little naive about algorithmic distribution. You know, I think there was a tendency to take at face value. Well, if this is what's popular, like clearly this is what everybody cares about, promote these sorts of things. And it brought in under the rug in a way that's different from like when Bernie Sanders ran for president and a lot of people started saying like, I'm a socialist now. People would be like, I don't know, like maybe I'm not a socialist, right? Or we would argue about it and they'd say, well, by socialism, I mean universal healthcare. And then he's like, well, but like in Canada, they have universal healthcare and that's not really, you know, and we were sort of negotiating it. Whereas on the identity side, I don't think it was that clear to me or to many other people, that these were ideas that were coming out of a like ideologically distinct school of thought, mm-hmm. that, you know, like critical race theorists describe themselves as being hostile to liberalism, mm-hmm. that like liberalism they feel is individualistic, is very focused on rights, is focused on ideas like colorblindness, and they were against that. But it wasn't presented as like long essays that are like, here's why we want to change the ideological foundations of how left of center people think about race and identity. It was just kind of like, here's why, you know, it's a microaggression to ask an Asian person, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
And like, the basic idea that like it might be offensive to treat somebody as like not, quote unquote, from here,
mm-hmm.
like that, you know, whatever. I think it's easy enough to understand. But like the concept of the microaggression has this like larger foundation behind it,
mm-hmm.
Versus just saying like, this could be seen as rude, mm-hmm. or like, maybe you shouldn't do that.
Well, I want to be more specific here because what ideas are you specifically talking about? Is it just sort of these ideas around identity and race that, you know, said that there's a group of people that's being disadvantaged in a systemic way, and that as a result, you need to change your speech, or we need to give them specific preferences? Like, what? How would you define the group of ideas you're talking
sure.
about?
Sure. I mean, I think Ibram Kendi's book has like the clearest articulation of what this alternative vision is, mm-hmm. right? Which is that he tries to take the subjective understanding of like racism as a kind of prejudice, as a kind of bigotry, as a kind of a mistreatment of an individual, and reconfigure it as like an objective question about how different groups are impacted by different things. And the only way to make that work is to like really reify these groups as such, right? It becomes like critically important to say like which groups are the real groups,
mm-hmm.
which are the ones that count definitively. How do people fit into the different groups, right? Because if you're going to assess these things on those objectivist terms, they need to have objective answers. And so you're necessarily swimming in like the opposite direction of like, I dream of, you know, seeing people on the content of their character, because mm-hmm. it becomes, you know, so it's like, me and Brian Beutler, we do a podcast together. I think in a common sense way, like we're both two white guys. But as it happens, he's half Chilean. Mm-hmm. I'm a quarter Cuban. And so like, is this like really a Latinx podcast? And
up
it's
to you.
Like, sure, like yes and no, right? Like I think as like normal people, mm-hmm. we understand that there are weird edge cases in life. And that like, you know, there's a difference between immigrant descended Black Americans mm-hmm. and like descendants of slaves. And like, there's a similarity, but there's also a difference. And then there's also like Caribbean versus African immigrants. Mm-hmm. And like life is complicated, right? But the Kendi schema like doesn't admit of those kind of complications. You need to have definitive answers all the time to like who fits where,
mm-hmm.
right? And even though he always seemed like a nice person who did not have like dystopian intentions mm-hmm. with any of this, it really only makes sense if you're like totally abandoning like liberal individual constitutionalism in favor of some like millet system,
mm-hmm.
because you're saying that people are benefiting or harmed by things that are happening to other people who just are in their same like communal group. And I think it's like quite toxic to just like trying to make things function well or the basic premises of liberalism, but it was played as just kind of an extension, as a, you know, like an expansion of the same old ideas, when it's actually like a quite radical conceptual break.
So I think that there's a level here where I agree that in most cases, if you help a random Black person, I am not like somehow feeling the benefits of that help. Mm-hmm. But there are like a lot of ways in which that's like not true, right? Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you're to say that we want to help, you know, make it, you know, we think it is really harmful whenever a Black person does not get picked up by a taxi driver in the rain. I mean, it's a famous, you know, problem. You know, we see that and like, I see another person have this happen to them. That discrimination that I am witnessing makes me feel bad because I see myself as potentially someone who would be receiving that or who has received that. So, like, and then with the vaccine situation, right, then there's even more of like a material question because, you know, yes, in like a direct sense, another Black person getting vaccinated does not protect me. But in a society where there is a lot of co-location of people of the same races, it is the case that like if you are interacting with more Black people as someone who is African American, then more people who are Black getting vaccinated is actually a benefit to you. Now, of course, these things kind of weigh out in like ways that, you know, I think likely, I mean, definitely the answer is to just give people who are the most at risk. But I think there's a question here of like, these groups are real, not in the discrete way that maybe Kendi is describing, but they are like real things that like liberals have recognized for decades and decades. And there are ways in which harming a member of that group or benefiting a member of that group can be beneficial to that group. I mean, this is an article. I mean, you mentioned this in your piece, but I recently wrote an article about, Karine Jean-Pierre's, really terrible memoir. And one of the problems I have with it is that she does not conceive of the point of representation, the purpose of someone with her background. She talks about being a gay Black woman who is now who was press secretary for Biden. The purpose of that is to help other people in that position, and that is true. We do see that when people who are women get to leadership positions, they do help people in their community. So I think there's a question here of like, descriptively, I think that like even if it can be correct that like helping members of a group help that group broadly, and if that group is disadvantaged, maybe we should want that.
Well, so I mean, two things, right? I mean, one, like the discrimination point, like I think is correct, right? I mean, people have part of how ethnic identity works is that people have a sense of linked fate, right? So like I remember when Sonia Sotomayor was up for her Supreme Court nomination, and I was taken aback by how strongly I felt about some of the things that other people were saying about her. It was like a moment of
A lot of people were calling her stupid. And
yeah,
like,
it was a moment of self-discovery for me. And going back to actually before her nomination, I was at a conference of progressive people, mostly focused on judicial issues. It's not really a subject that I cover very much. It was during the, you know, Obama transition. But so I was asking some of these people, I was like, who do you think Obama's going to put up for a Supreme Court vacancy? And, you know, a very distinguished law professor goes, oh, Sonia Sotomayor. And like other people were shaking their heads. And I was like, what's up? Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And he was like, he didn't want to say it, but it was like, well, you know, like he's going to want to put Hispanic on the court. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. Like, and I was like, what, like, what's going on? And these other professors, they were like very derogatory about her, that she didn't, one of them said she didn't have the intellectual sparkle to be a Supreme Court justice. And so I took offense at this. I was like, what are you, like, what's going on here? Like, what are you guys talking about?
And they're all progressives, like you said. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, they were like, I don't even want to say, they were like progressive second and snobs first. You know what I mean? So it's like, they weren't like against her, but it's like, I don't know, like they were law professors. So they like really wanted the next Supreme Court justice to be like the greatest law professor in human history rather than a Puerto Rican former prosecutor. Anyway, all that aside, like I took offense like personally, right? Yeah. I was like, yeah, this like kind of sucks. And then she herself had this much criticized statement that like she thinks in some cases, like a wise Latina might reach a different conclusion from somebody who had a different identity, which I just think is a descriptive fact, like is true, right? Like people see things differently based on their experiences in life. And if you have a diverse set of people in like a rough and ready sense,
yeah,
that gives you a more panopticonal, you know, kind of view. So I think that's all fine, right? Like those kind of pragmatics of diversity and stuff are good and are important. But it also does like, you have to think about the domain that you're dealing with, right? So part of the nature of like appellate jurisprudence is that like you are constantly supposed to be the person who vindicates the rights of the individual against like the crushing maw of the state. Mm-hmm. So making sure that people in those roles like have their eye on like the lived experience of insular minority groups seems like really, really, really important to that job. I remember an article from like the peak woke era, and it was like about how like there's too much whiteness in marine biology. And like, the piece didn't, I'm not saying that's not true, but like the piece didn't attempt to persuade me that there was like some actual issue.
That there was
like,
an impact.
Yeah. Okay. Like, that, like this had anything to do with the work of marine biology. It mm-hmm. just kind of seemed like a marine biologist wanted to like feel relevant mm-hmm. to the cultural trends of the era. So they were like observing that the marine biology field is very white, but like, is that important? Like, is it relevant to what's happening there? Whereas again, I was in a newsroom. I think you can easily see why diversity is important to a newsroom. Mm-hmm. But then the question of like, in what sense is it important, right? Because like the newsroom in question was statistically like overweight on Asians mm-hmm. and underweight on Black and Hispanic people. But it wasn't like there were no Black or Hispanic staffers or like a bajillion Asians. It's mm-hmm. just that in America, there's way more African-American Latino people, very yeah. few Asians. But like the Asian category is incredibly heterogeneous. Mm-hmm. And like actually having like a Filipino origin person and a Korean origin person and an Indian, that's like more diversity in like a literal sense of like, we want diverse. Mm-hmm. And so like, who's to say, right? Like, I don't think there's like an objective, like exact correct ethnic headcount for your newsroom. Mm-hmm. Trying to be diverse on some dimensions more than others is like almost certainly good. But that's different, I think, from the view that, you know, we need to sort of treat these categories yeah. as like the critical building blocks
yes.
of our experience.
So like, part of what I'm drawing out of what you're saying is that a lot of the thinking of this time led to, okay, we need to perfectly match on these existing groups that we've all collectively decided are the ones that matter, even if our goal is, well, actually, it would be really important for us to get more coverage of Southeast Asia. So even if we have, we've overweighted on Asians already, that like we need to go find someone who could write well and cogently about Southeast Asia. And like that would be a way of increasing diversity, if that person ended up being South Asian, increasing diversity in your newsroom. But that's like a very different approach to the problem than we're just looking at these broad-based groups and going like, well, we're 1% off the population rate, and so we have to hire a Black person right now.
Sure. Well, and also I just think to acknowledge that like there's not, the history of like race and ethnicity in America is complicated mm-hmm. and it's different in all different countries and all different things like that. And, you know, you can't... there's both like a reason why a like Asian bucket racial group was like created in America mm-hmm. and also like a level on which that's, I don't want to say it's like not real because like none of this stuff is real, but it's like more not real.
But this is a place where I think I actually disagree with you, because I think a lot of these groups that everyone has always, I mean, most people have always acknowledged they're not like discrete categories and there's a ton of confusion. They're created because in the United States, if you are to say, actually, instead of Asian Americans organizing as a group together, we're going to have Chinese Americans and Korean Americans and Filipino Americans, et cetera. Like those people are such a small sliver of the population. They would quite literally never be able to access right. the benefits that their community might want. And so actually tying their fates together and creating this Asian American identity was actually like very, very useful. And I think this is also true in like a global sense where, for instance, if the global South are hundreds of countries, which are very different from one another in many, many ways. But if they don't act ever in any kind of solidarity towards, you know, trying to get certain benefits out of, you know, higher industrialized nations, then like they're not going to be able to do anything. So there's like a question of like the ability to even do politics in a world where minority groups like have to band together. Do you think that that necessarily leads to the type of liberalism you're talking about?
I mean, I guess my view of all of this is that there's a difference between a pragmatics approach, right? Where it's like, we need to like do something. We're going to try to have some organization. We're going to try to be diverse. We're going to mm-hmm. try to, you know, like old fashioned, like ticket balancing, like going to like way before the civil rights era, there's a view that like a New York Democratic ticket mm-hmm. should have like an Irish guy and a Jewish guy and then one person from upstate on it, right? And that's like identity politics. But it was taken in the spirit of like, we're just trying to win, mm-hmm. right? Sort of like what you're saying, right? It's like, we got to like team up, right? To yeah. accomplish something. Or, you know, even like, it's good to show some solidarity. Like, it's good for people to think about people other than themselves in a super narrow sense. Yeah. And so like, yeah, like similarity can be like a bridge to universalism,
yes,
right? But it can also go the other way, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like breaking down universalism in order to kind of pillarize society. And so, you know, there's some back and forth on these kind of things, and that's fine. But I think it's important to hold out as like a regulative ideal, right? That like we're going to try to see people as individuals, to judge people as individuals, to like, yes, say that like the real world probably doesn't work that way, mm-hmm. but that's bad, right? Not that we need to be like constantly increasing
yeah.
the kind of consciousness. And again, I think it's very clear to everyone on the center left why it's problematic when people from the right do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not... you'd have to be kind of a moron to look at the names in the indictment of the original Minneapolis fraud case and like not notice that there's something going on there.
Yeah.
But like, it's not the correct way to respond to those things by running around talking about how Somalis are terrible.
Yes.
Like, that's not correct. And to like encourage everyone to think about program integrity in primarily ethnic terms is like, that's bad. Mm-hmm. You are doing something, even if you're being 100% factual,
mm-hmm.
like you are like committing, it's antisocial behavior.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. To be engaging in this kind of thing. Sometimes it's like a forced move and like you have to talk about the ethnic identity of people who are doing things that are bad, but it like mostly isn't.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like not good. It's not constructive to living in a diverse, pluralistic society to do certain kinds of things like that. Even if you want to say, look, like I want to adjust how refugee admissions work, that's mm-hmm. still different from like, I want to say there's an ethnic group that had a refugee founder population. I think those people are bad.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's
and I think
better
yeah.
to do that kind of stuff for like well-meaning reasons, mm-hmm. but it's not that much better. Honestly.
And I think the thing that's important to draw out here is that when people engage in this sort of thinking, they end up, as you said, reifying the groups and making them much more relevant to how people think about themselves and other people. And so, I mean, one way that I think this is obviously true is that like when you, if you were to take just sort of like do a genome study and like just divide populations up based on, you know, hair color or mm-hmm. on, or even other random things like height or like any attribute, both personality or physical characteristic, you would find differences between the groups. Like they're not going to all perfectly match up, that like there's no differences between people who are like redheads or have different height or yeah. less like have eye color, whatever. But like we often don't talk about like, oh, the fact that we're wearing glasses indicates like X thing. We don't like look at that information and draw a bunch of inferences and then construct our identities around the fact that we wear glasses and that we have like bad eyesight and that means X thing about ourselves, even if there are like statistical truths about it. And part of that is because like it's kind of like not the way groups function right now. Like obviously there's not like a power differential between glasses wearers and non-glasses wearers. Part of it too is like, if you were to do that over time, you would create group disparities that would be entrenched because people would begin to act on those stereotypes in ways that would be harmful. I think that's something that I think often conservatives really chafe against when they might hear this conversation. They go like, you guys are just telling us to like reject facts about the world. It's sort of like, you are also creating reality as well as, and constructing it by the things that you are saying and arguing. You're not just like reflecting it at the same time. Like the more that you talk about this, the more that you make group differences relevant to how people think about themselves. And so I think that is underappreciated. But the thing we haven't talked about in your article yet so far is a big part of your article is this idea that these arguments snuck in
yeah.
to liberalism and amongst liberals, and that like, I mean, the metaphor of a fox in a hen house is what you use. And I'm like, I've been mulling this over for a while because I think there's like a, obviously there's like a rhetorical persuasive element to yeah. what you're doing there, but there's also like a question of like, how literally true is this, that it was like an unconscious, like nobody knew what these arguments meant and like it just took over. And I think that like we tend to really underrate that these arguments were just persuasive on the merits for various reasons. I think that, like, let's taking the specific example you use around Asian Americans and the perpetual foreigner stereotype, mm-hmm. right? So he's writing the article, and you just talked about it earlier, about how, you know, there is this idea that comes up around, like, asking Asian Americans, where are you from, is racist. And the idea comes from this idea, from the observation that Asian Americans are more likely to be treated as if they don't belong here. It is, like, quite difficult to, like, find out how prevalent the stereotype is. But I did find that, like, in 2022 Pew polling, 39% of Asian adults say that they've been in a situation where people act like they don't speak English. 32% say that someone's told them to go back to their own country. Regardless of nativity, similar shares of US-born Asian adults have experienced these incidents. So it seems like probably descriptively true that, like, what's happening when someone asks an Asian American, not always, but, like, often when someone's asking, like, where are you really from? They are in some way saying, like, I don't believe that you're really from here. We can have, like, a convert. I don't think it's really relevant, like, how impactful that is, but, like, that is clearly what's happening. They're being treated as a member of a group, and they're being in some ways judged and treated as, like, less than an American, white American for their racial background. And, like, I think that, like, not only is this, like, probably accurate, but also that, like, the question is really, what do you do about this, or, like, what can you do about this? And that, like, the answer that you should be rude to people who say, you know, where are you really from, is not actually, like, helpful at, like, the end goal of, like, assimilating Asian Americans into American culture. But, like, I think that that is, like, the place to focus on, not this idea that, like, that's inherently liberal to notice that, like, discriminatory patterns exist.
I mean, yes, but I think,
like, that to me is a persuasive argument. Also, you know what I mean?
I mean, this one always rankled me when I read it on takes, because, like, I get asked, where are you from, several times a year by different sorts of people. And it is almost always a working class Hispanic person mm-hmm. who is, like, trying to say, like, what's up with, like, you and, like,
you seem white, but your last name is Iglesias.
Yeah. And I had, like, this happened to me, like, literally yesterday. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it was an immigrant from Belarus, mm-hmm. Who was doing it, which made it, like, even more clear that this was, like, a question of, like, language barriers and, like, cultural competencies and, like, in a way trying to, like, not be rude, mm-hmm. but just being like, you have blue eyes, like, what's up with your name?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Kind of stuff. And it's like, I don't know. You know, it's like, what is the best way to ask that, right? Like, I think that, like, a lot of people are aware because they are elevated and wise, and they know that, like, people of Korean ancestry and Chinese ancestry and Japanese ancestry are, in fact, quite different. Mm-hmm. And that these are very different cultures and societies, but they cannot, like, tell by mm-hmm. eyeball, like, who is who. And they are, like, trying to ask about that. Mm-hmm. And they are struggling to come up with the correct phraseology. I don't know. In my personal life,
I think the thing is, like, what you're describing here is that the implementation of the advice to not ask people where they're from, or to treat that as a racist question, is often done in a poor way. So, for instance, like, I think that, like, most people who I know who are like, oh, you shouldn't ask someone where they're from, we're not, like, getting mad at, like, working class people who are in good faith asking this question. They were annoyed at, like, people who seem like they were being racist. And, like, there's a question here about, like, okay, well, now are you just expanding this to people who are not trying to be racist? And, like, yes, you're right, some people will be harmed that way. But there's just a question here of, like, is it harm for Asian American people to experience this question? Like, they're just, like, people can decide these things for themselves. And, like, I don't really get why this is different than just saying, you know, we've updated the manners rule book and some people haven't gotten the memo yet, but they will.
Well, I mean, I think that's fine. Like, that's way more chill than the phraseology of a lot of these articles, mm-hmm. frankly. You know, I think that, because to me, like, part of the subtext of this kind of thing was that people have been encouraged to sort of exaggerate their own vulnerability and fragility mm-hmm. and these kind of things, right? That it was like, in to, like, be a victim mm-hmm. in some ways. And so wanted to, like, blow it up. You know what I mean? In, like, a more grandiose way than like it really was. I mentioned William Julius Wilson a million years ago in this conversation. And, you know, like his thought about this stuff is always very influential to mm-hmm. me, right? And like one of his points is that to the extent that you take racism seriously as like a problem in American society and something that motivates a lot of action and that does a lot of harms, it means that you as a progressive person probably want to downplay this. Like a lot, like you don't want to like inject a lot of racial discourse into the political space. You want to, you know, and so in the early days of the Affordable Care Act dispute, when I was working at Center for American Progress at that time, and the late Rush Limbaugh, he had this like rant on the radio about how this isn't really a healthcare bill. This is a reparations bill. This is a civil rights bill, like by which he That was bad yeah. to him, right? Like he's trying to make a law to help low-income people seem bad in the eyes of his white audience mm-hmm. by saying it's a reparations bill. 5 years later, Center for American Progress is like putting out charts mm-hmm. that are showing how impactful the Affordable Care Act was in like closing the racial healthcare access gap. And I remember asking the person who was doing that, I was like, you remember 5 years ago when like this was Rush Limbaugh's bit? Mm-hmm. Like what are we doing now? And he was saying to me, he's like, well, you know, like a lot of the young people on staff, like they don't really think this healthcare issue is like that interesting. And we're like trying to like make it seem like more important and more interesting to them. And I was like, well, okay, fair enough.
But I think I'm just because like you're making now a strategic argument about like the fact that like the majority of people in this country are white or definitely are not black. And so therefore you're going to like, if you make the bill seem like it's just for black people, there's a problem there. But like, I think back to like the original
yeah.
question here around whether or not these ideas snuck in, like in that case, what's happening is that people are attempting to persuade. They realize that people care a lot about reifying or about fixing group disparities and that they're concerned about the harms done to Black Americans in this country and they want to redress them. And therefore they're making arguments about how like that's good and that this bill will help do that. And so like that feels like actually a very like conscious decision to make arguments like this.
Yes. I mean, there was a conscious decision to flip the yes. traditional idea, right? Of
yes.
like addressing problems through race neutral mm-hmm. economic policies and to like turn that around inside out as a like internal messaging strategy on the left. But I still think that raises the question of like, how is it that there was this like growing block of people inside mainstream center left institutions who were like basically rejecting individual analysis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't 100% know. You know, like I like put forward my account in the argument, like through the media, through social media, through generational change, through stuff that happened in the higher education system. But this is, you know, I sometimes write pieces where I'm like, here's a chart,
yeah.
you know, here's like a time series. I don't 100% know. I continue to think that this is a little bit of an under discussed and under explored kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there was some kind of I hesitate to even say generational because it's people quite close to me in age, but like a little bit younger than me seem to have had some totally different set of like structuring assumptions about like what's important and like what politics is
mm-hmm.
and how the world works and so on and so forth. One thing that, I mean, again, this whole like Somali thing has impacted my thinking a lot. And I do think that some of it is just optimism. That people who were a little too young for like the politics of the early 1990s just kind of like assumed that like cranking up the dial would like always be constructive and that like the only question to ask about like racial progress in the Obama era was like, are things like changing fast enough? And so we should just be like relentlessly trying to push the pace,
mm-hmm.
like by any means necessary, including like slightly sly. I mean, my main objection to that characterization of the healthcare bill from both the Rush Limbaugh and the Progressive Way is like, that's like not what the bill does.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't. Like, mm-hmm. you can characterize it that way if you want, but it has nothing to do with the design of the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it just doesn't. It's like Rush Limbaugh's just lying. when he says it's reparations, and to then turn it around and be like, it's reparations in a good way, it's like still not true.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, right, like there was a change in the strategic thought. And I do hope that people like now see just like it's possible to lose ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like atavistic conservatism didn't go away like at any point in time. It became stigmatized in elite circles and people didn't do it. You know, like high level Republicans didn't do it for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But like, this is like a big, like potent, dangerous force in society. And to be like deliberately unleashing those kind of dynamics is like really risky, has like huge downsides, very limited upsides.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in part, some of these changes were coming from a place of like overly exuberant, optimism. And you'd mentioned a similar thought about sort of like free speech concepts. I mean, in some ways, like the core idea of liberalism, one of the core ideas of liberalism is that you expect there will be some alternation of mm-hmm. like who's in power, and you're trying to like mitigate the downsides of losing so that everybody can live together and cooperate and have like a peaceful democratic governance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there was maybe just like a moment of hubris when it was like,
I think this a lot. I mean, I was talking to Greg Lukianoff, who we had on the podcast here a few weeks ago, who is the head of FIRE, the free speech organization. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we were talking very similarly about like what happened in changes around norms around free speech. And I mean, I was just like, I mean, it's like, I'm 30. So I was, you know, when Obama got elected the first time in 2008, I was 13 years old. I was 13 years old. And, you know, my entire like political coming of age in my teens was like really a sense of just like, there's like, no, like we've just won these like big questions in American politics. Like the thing that we've won is like obvious. And I think that like, this is not like new to this generation. I think this is like just true. Like whenever, like, I'm sure that like 13-year-olds when Reagan was elected had kind of like similar views about like the big questions having been resolved. But like the problem for liberals is that like when you think that like these questions have been resolved, the only question is like, well, let's just beat these bad people into the ground and like, let's just make all of these benefits that we want to accrue to marginalized groups, to like all the progress we want to see. Like, let's just go as fast as we can. And it really, I mean, I think that's why there was a lot of shock in people in my generation. I think sometimes less so than with older generations when Trump won, because I think there was like a real belief that there's like no way that could ever happen. And I do think this question of like, once you believe in permanent victory, like, will you ever respect the rights or beliefs of people who are different than you is like just been proved like over and over and over again. But I do want to get to something which I think is a critique of like sometimes levied at both of us, which is this question of why are we even talking about this in like the age of Trump? Like, why are you writing this article? Like, why are we talking about it? Why even having like entre-left fights at all mm-hmm. in an age where like, okay, if someone were to say like, oh, I'm really concerned about people stigmatizing groups, the idea that you would spend any time at all thinking about what the left is doing at an age when Trump is doing all this, I mean, the Somalians is one thing, but like sure. every single part of the immigration policy, every single part of what they're talking about with DEI, et cetera, these are not like liberal critiques trying to like fix diversity. And I think there's this implicitly what you're arguing is, and maybe I'm wrong here, is that like opening the gates to this in the progressive era was a causal influence to what's going on right now.
I mean, I think it was in part a causal influence on what's going on right now. I think it has like, you know, lost part of why these inevitable triumphs don't actually come together is that like you push the envelope further and further and you actually lose people, mm-hmm. you know, who were in your coalition, right? So like, I think, I voted for Kamala Harris, but I think that I was on the more conservative side of the people who voted for Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other people who are like, not that ideologically distant from me, who voted for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of those people voted for Joe Biden 4 years earlier, and definitely voted for Obama's reelection in 2012, mm-hmm. right? But it's like, there's been a breakdown of the liberalism space. Like you said, taking it for granted that like all the stuff Trump is doing here is not like an effort to like vindicate liberal principles.
Mm-hmm.
I think I agree with you about that. I think Barry Weiss probably disagrees with both of us. While she would say, though, that she believes broadly similar things about, like, America, mm-hmm. right? Or the West, or whatever else it is. And so part of it is, yeah, like, you fumble the bag and you lose people. Some of it is that, like, when you lose, particularly the way, you know, if you're going to try to come back, it's like you have to come back with something different. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, I mean, I get the idea that it's like, if Trump is doing bad things, like, all you should do is 24/7 talk about that and, like, try to stop him. But also, if you're not going to talk about, like, what's your plan for if you govern again when you're out of power, like, when are you going to talk about it?
Yeah.
Because when you're in power, it's like, it's sort of too late. Mm-hmm. You know, Biden administration did stuff. A lot of the stuff they did, I thought was good. Some of the stuff they did, I thought was bad. I could, like, write my columns, but, like, it doesn't matter. It's mm-hmm. like, he already has in place, like, his key people, their ideas, the agenda is what it is. It's when you're out of power mm-hmm. that you can shape the future course of events with much more sort of potency. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, as a writer, I need to balance between, okay, well, what's most objectively significant right now is, like, things that people in power are doing. But where I have the most leverage is where people who are out of power are thinking about mm-hmm. their own internal squabbles. So, you know, try to balance it a little bit. I also think, you know, always in life, you know, after action reports are important, you know, like, you have to think about what worked and what didn't work. And I think it would be, I don't think anybody particularly thinks that the, like, big post 2015 push around racial justice has over the past 10 years had, like, incredible substantive successes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I don't see a lot of people who are interested in, like, talking about, like, why was that? Mm-hmm. Like, what went wrong here? Like, I mean, maybe you could find someone, but, like, I don't know anyone who's like, the years 2016 through 2025, this was the peak. Like, that's mm-hmm. when we really solved things and figured stuff out. Right. So, but there was a lot of effort. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk. There was a lot of takes. There was a lot of, like, big commitments made. And so, you know, when it's not like, well, we didn't try and that's why we didn't make progress. It's like a lot of stuff occurred
mm-hmm.
and net net we seem to have ended up in a worse place than when we started, so, like, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And, like, calls for some examination.
That encapsulates a lot of my answer, but I also say that, you know, at times when you have lost, and not just in an electoral sense, but, like, I think everyone can see in various ways that, like, ideas left of center are losing cachet in various places, like, just the prevalence mm-hmm. of, like, people using various slurs now in ways that they just weren't a couple of years ago. The fact that, like, people feel much more comfortable just making comments about, like, women needing to go back to the kitchen or whatever. Like, these are just, like, things that people could observe even if they're not paying attention to politics. Mm-hmm. It, like, feels different. Like, in these moments, what's important is, like, okay, majority of, like, the voters, like, picked someone who was going to lead us in this direction. The thing that is now relevant is to provide an alternative that is more attractive. And so, like, the biggest thing to focus on, if you are not someone who is, like, directly working to, like, you know, I don't know, do lawsuits right now or whatever, or, you know, help individual people who are losing benefits because of the Trump administration, is, like, to, like, help create this new version that will be the new alternative to the J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio candidacies in 2028.
Well, and I also think in terms of, you know, the vibe shift you yeah. referenced, right? We shifted, like, very dramatically, very literally from this kind of, like, woke vibe to the opposite
mm-hmm.
vibe. And, like, I just, like, genuinely think that both of those vibes are incorrect, and that the, like, correct, better vibe that has traditionally represented the best traditions of the United States of America has, like, fallen into a subsumed place,
mm-hmm.
and that it's important to articulate it more clearly, and to, like, not, but also to be clear about what we're saying, that, like, just kind of point and be like, yo, that's racist mm-hmm. when Republicans say something racist without clarifying, like, what do I mean by that? You know what I mean? Because I actually mean something somewhat different from what Kendi says or what people who are obsessed with like racial diversity and marine biology say. Like, I have a different view of this that I think ultimately is like more persuasive and more compelling than the kind of like zero sum scramble between like left and right identitarianisms. And then you see a little bit of it in how sort of befuddled like Vivek Ramaswamy became when like it turned out that like there's a lot of people who want to say bigoted
things. Vivek Ramaswamy is running for governor of Ohio. He is he wrote an article in the New York Times about how he's really upset about how racist people are to Indian Americans.
On one hand, it's like a little bit of a like, you know, leopards eating my face kind of thing. But also, like, I see where he's coming from. Like, if you tuned into politics relatively late in the game, and like all you ever heard about was like left-wing people who are like obsessed with racial disparities and like you need to level things. And like Indian Americans are very affluent, very high achieving, very high status, very elite group in the United States. You would think that like the whole discourse was like left-wing people trying to tear down Indian Americans, maybe like in a nice way, but like objectively, and like right-wing people saying like, no, like merit is important, right? And then like he's left looking around, he's like, oh wait, like a lot of these people are just bigots. They just hate people who are different from them. And I'm appalled. And like, I agree with him. Like, he should be appalled. And like, we should articulate like why it is that that is appalling. And then it continues to be appalling, even though like objectively Indian Americans are doing well. We don't need to like wait for the point at which anti-Indian bigotry manages to like yank their median income below the national average to like say that it's bad. It's bad on its own terms. You know what I mean? And like, that's something that should be said, because it is true that like the left abandoned the view that it's bad on its own terms, or at least like lost the conceptual resources to articulate like why that would be bad, right? Or like what's going on. And I was talking to somebody about like competing definitions of anti-Semitism, and like it was just like all people wanted to argue about was Israel, because you know, people like to argue about Israel. But I wanted to say that like I actually think what's important is this like objective hierarchy of oppression concept versus like a traditional concept that like some people don't like Jews and like that's bad, right? Like it's like also true that Jews do well in America on average objectively, but you're just still allowed to like be upset about people being racist about you. And like you should say that it's bad for people to do that. It's like also true that like I think like people from groups that are small numerical minorities, but that are also doing well, should try to maintain some awareness of that, that is different from being in a subordinate position in society. Like, we're doing well in America. We don't need to be like super paranoid all the time about everything. But like, you know, you can just like not want people to be bigoted against you. That's like a totally normal, valid human response. And not everything needs to be, you know, these like hierarchical categories. And so it's like, we need to say that because those ideas are like true and important and valuable and got like taken for granted to the point where they, I think to like young people, like may not even be visible, you know, like you may not even know what like debates used to be like.
So last thing I want to ask you about this article is around individualism in general, because I think that like, you know, I think both of us see individualism as like a core plank of what liberalism or liberals think. But like, it's almost like a dirty word right now. It's something I've been thinking about for a little bit. And then Mamdani, in his speech, said something about the, you know, frigidity of rugged individualism. And, you know, I don't want to like debate like the whole speech or what he was trying to say or whatever. But I think that there's like largely, I've noticed a very strong kind of antipathy to these ideas that American individualism or these individuals in general is good. And my read on it has been that for some reason, the word individualism has come to mean selfishness and that like collectivism or like community oriented, thinking is like when you are like nice to your neighbors in any capacity, you're like engaged with them. And I like, this seems to me like actually a very core problem for liberals right now, that like individualism itself is like under attack. But I think part of the issue is that like lots and lots of people actually do increasingly, or maybe like I'm just noticing it more, do really want to be part of a community, and like that community and group like organization is like valuable to them, and they actually do want to reify. They hear this conversation, they're like, okay, yeah, but like I think that is, it is good, and I just want my group to be on top, and like, you know, we have various reasons why like that will be bad for everyone, etc., in the long run. But I do think there's like this problem here where like maybe our tastes are actually losing at like not a conceptual confusion level, at a literal what people want level.
So I mean, I think part of what's going on there is that, you know, there's a lot of sort of adjacent subjects, right? Like one question is sort of atomization, mm-hmm. right? Like people not being involved in community institutions.
Bowling alone, yeah.
And I think there's a lot of discourse now about how that's bad, although there's also the reality that it's been increasing. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure who's winning or who's losing there. But I don't think that's what individualism in the liberal sense is about, mm-hmm. one way or the other. Like I think people should have friends. I think people should like be in clubs.
Be other nice things to their
like
neighbors.
That.
Yeah.
That like liberal societies actually benefit from people being in,
yes,
like literally in groups, mm-hmm. where they do things together. The other question is like individualism as selfishness, mm-hmm. Which I also think is something that's been on the rise in our society, right? Is toward this kind of like atavism and not caring about each other. I take it from the like cold warm part of the Mamdani metaphor, mm-hmm. that's what he had in mind, yeah. that he wants people to care more about each other. Maybe. I mean, I think the use of the term collectivism was odd.
It was weird.
That's like, yeah. not something I actually hear people say, yeah. including people I disagree with.
He's always been weird in speeches though, so whatever.
Sure. Yeah. But like, you know, yes, like people should care about other people. I agree with that. You know, individualism though to me is taking seriously the fact that each person is in fact their own person and not a statistical conglomerate of other people, mm-hmm. and that this is like a really important fact about, I don't know, fact. It's like a moral premise,
yeah.
right, of our society. And, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, right, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And like, I'm not like a literal believer in like God, the creator, making us all equal and endowing us with rights, but as a like political concept, mm-hmm. that like we want to organize America on a constitutional and legal basis as if it is the case that we are all individual creations endowed with our individual rights, to me is like a good premise for how a diverse society should operate. Mm-hmm. I saw like a really interesting dialogue where some right-wing people were talking about how homogenous America was at the founding, which is certainly true by contemporary lights. It's, I think, really important to understand, though, that the founders understood themselves to be in a very diverse society. Mm-hmm. Like at that time,
yes.
the difference between a Catholic and a Protestant, or like a Quaker or a Dutch guy and an English guy,
they were killing each other over it.
It seemed
Europe.
Very yeah. significant yeah. to them, yeah. right? And they felt that this was like a big issue.
Yeah.
And that, like, how were they going to have like a cooperative republic? And like, mm-hmm. they were thinking about this all the time, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, we today continue to be a diverse society that like needs to take seriously the question of like, how do you have a constructive cooperative relationship across these various kinds of social cleavages? And like, the answer isn't atomization. It's not like, you know, like their aspiration wasn't like, well, there won't be Quakers in the
yes.
future. It's that like your Quakerness will not be the organizing principle of the political system. Mm-hmm. It might be the organizing principle of your life, or it might not. Mm-hmm. But that like they anticipated that people would continue to have religious affiliations and would do these different things, and that would be an important part of their lives, but that it wasn't going to be how we would organize our society. Like, which is not obvious, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in Lebanon, the parliamentary seats are divided based on, are you a Christian or are you a Muslim? Mm-hmm. Are you a Sunni or are you a Shiite? If you're a Christian, are you Catholic or are you Orthodox? You know, and it's divided down that way. And that's like an Ottoman legacy. It's in some ways a pragmatic response to the features of Lebanese society. But like, it's very illiberal. It's completely alien to the American political tradition. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not to say that people should be socially, should be lonely or should be selfish or should be atavistic. You know, and I think that like some of the thoughts and premises and ideas around like abundance are like trying to find ways to like talk about these things in ways that like sound a little more aspirational, a little nicer, mm-hmm. maybe than just like, well, we should be individualistic. But that like, you know, we want that, to-
Like you have the right to move to New York City and get an apartment and do a job. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, or that you should have the things that you want, yeah. you know, a bit, and you should be able to have them for yourself, mm-hmm. not just like handed down through a rationing system or a quota system or something like that. So I don't always know, but I think that the technical terminology of individualism is valuable in certain ways because it like it matters in legal context, it matters in constitutional context, it matters I think for like how we should write stories, mm-hmm. like what should we be doing, and like I think we want to characterize America as like composed of individual human beings who do things as individuals and who have things happen to them as individuals. One of the things they will do as individuals is affiliate with groups, mm-hmm. and they may subjectively have their own different levels of feeling about how connected they are to mm-hmm. other people who are similar to them in certain kinds of ways, but that like the government should not treat those affiliations as core in evaluating what's going on. It should evaluate what's happening to yeah. the individuals as individuals.
I totally agree with what you're saying, and I think that there's, you know, especially like just trying to distinguish what it actually means to be individualistic in a liberal sense. But I think that like it's not just that people are misapplying the word. I think that there's also a sense that we can use like abundance as an example. One thing that I've gotten from some people who are on the more like post-liberal side, and this was, I think, you know, this is at a conference that was Chatham House Rules, so I can't really talk about it, but talk about who said it. But basically, I've gotten these questions around, well, if anyone can just sort of like move anywhere, and they're like, you know, we build all the housing in like Los Angeles and San Francisco and the suburbs, and then they abandon all these communities, and like these communities just die. And I think there's actually like a large, widespread sense that like giving people the option to go to jobs that exist in like superstar cities and suburbs, or even just like the capital city of their state that they live in right now, would be bad, even if it was individually good for that person. And that's a choice they were making to make themselves happier or more fulfilled or whatever it is, because the community itself should have a right over that individual. And like ways that like liberals have often reconciled this is often like that, like, yeah, of course, like you can like form duty bonds with people in your community that you choose to honor by your own like decision. Like if they're like, hey, yeah, I have been raised in a community that is like very, you know, important to me, and like that I want them to continue to flourish or whatever. Like I want to stay here, even though it might be more individually rational for me to earn a higher salary in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Like that's completely reasonable and fine. You can choose to do that. But I think there's people who are like, no, like it is very, very hard to make that choice if the government is not actively investing to force firms, for instance, break up and move to these. So that is, I think, an idea that is less a conceptual conviction, is actually like a rejection of individualism in the liberal sense.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I always observe about that is that people who say that almost always also have a misperception that in the past people moved less than they do now.
Yeah.
So they think that they want to abandon our current excessively footloose society to return to a time when people were more rooted. But if you look at it, in fact, in the past, people moved more than they do now, and we've become more rooted. And the advocates of rootedness do not seem to feel that the trend is positive. Mm-hmm. So I'm always like a little bit optimistic that we can actually reach a higher synthesis here, because both sides are actually agreeing that the previous situation was better.
Mm-hmm. Well, Yoni Applebaum has a synthesis, right, in his book Stuck, where, I mean, it's not, you know, his original observation, but I think he does it really well around when people are moving more, they are the ones who are more likely to join all of these like local community groups. Cause like, just think about it. When you move, you're like, oh, I got to make some friends, got to find some community. I'm going to go to church more than I was getting to before, or I'm going to like go to a local volleyball league. So you, I mean, here in DC, which is maybe kind of like an outlier place because you have a lot, a high percentage of transplants, because of the government work that happens here, is you go to these like new clubs and they're like disproportionately newcomers.
Right.
But this is true in like all cities. There's a disproportionate number of newcomers in these clubs. It's not to say the people who are from those places and grew up there and been their whole lives don't matter, but that these people who are moving a lot actually provide a lot of the foot traffic and, you know, energy towards these community groups, and that like by moving less, you're actually having less of that energy come to your town.
Well, the other thing I would say is like one reason people don't move as much as they used to, I mean, some of it's like housing stuff, but some of it is that like the country has actually become more homogenous, right? It used to be that regional economies were more different from each other. So there was more reason to move, right?
Boom, and so, bus towns.
Right. And, so I think people, well, and also just the you know, the industry mix was more different. And so I think people felt that the situation was more rooted because the different places were more distinctive, right? And like, I agree. I, as a like totally abstract aesthetics thing, I think it's like a little bit, and I don't know, like,
you don't love that everywhere has the same coffee shop with an industrial vibe.
Yeah, I'm kind of like,
I love it. It makes me feel at home.
Right. I mean, I don't know. You know, I and I'm like, I kind of, as somebody who likes to travel, I just sort of like abstractly wish that different places were more different from how they used to be. But if that was true, people would move more. You know, it's like they would sort more aggressively.
Yes.
Right. So like part of what's happening is that like things are flattened. There's less need to actually move. I don't know. I can't promise you that like in the Yimbytopia, places will become more distinctive again.
Well, they necessarily possible. Will be if you, I mean, this is getting off far afield, but if you like kill, you know, design standards and historic preservation stuff, people can just do a bunch of cool art stuff with houses, like you get more distinctiveness.
Right. I mean, things will be more weird.
But also just like Philadelphia, for instance, like it's a place where I've spent a lot of time because my sister lives there. And like, that is a city where like there are much lower commercial rents than like New York City. And like, it is a very big city. It's an industrial city. Yes. There's tons of places. So you have like really random and weird like shops, like you have like an entire store where there's like almost, there's like all cassette tapes. Like this could not be sustained in a place where like commercial, like I think Yimbytopia could get us to diversity.
Right. And you know, and there's other things that, you know, in my book, in 1 Billion Americans, you know, I talk about like how part of just all of this is like, people have always left rural areas to go to the big city, but they used to have more children than they currently do. So like the impact of that attrition, there's a, like a paradoxical thing about like small town vibes in general, which is that if people leave, your small town dies. Mm-hmm. But if people come, it's not a small town anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And so like actually hit that nostalgia equilibrium is like challenging, right? Yeah. And I hear what people are saying about all these kinds of things. Or, you know, I think about like my mom used to always complain about how like Little Italy in New York had like kind of gone away because like she liked it. But also she wasn't like, well, like Italian American immigrants shouldn't be allowed to like assimilate and move to the site. You know, it was just a complaint.
Yeah.
And like, I think that's totally fine. Like people, particularly as we get older, are just entitled to be grumpy and nostalgic for how we remember things when we were kids. But we should distinguish that from like a real take. Mm-hmm. Like I kind of miss like when U Street was like an incredibly shitty slum, but like it was like worse actually. It's just like I was 24 at the time and I lived there and like you could get super cheap beer or like go to a bar that illegally stayed open past 3 a.m. because like there was no enforcement of anything. Mm-hmm. And also just like I was young and having fun, right? But with like rational brain, like that was worse, right? It's just that I'm lame and middle-aged now. And so, you know, things like hit me harder in a negative kind of way. So, you know, I think that like we should try to have people be happy where they are, right? That like that's like a good community.
Yeah.
I think that like trapping people as a community building strategy, like it seems very dubious. And I don't think that the people who say they want that are like happy with the results
I'll also just say they're disproportionately concentrated in these superstar cities themselves.
Many of them are. And there's also like a niche thing, right? Which is that there's these, in the Northeastern United States mm-hmm. has a certain number of like boutique small towns. Like mm-hmm. I summer in Maine mm-hmm. in a very nice little coastal town.
You really
town.
Are middle-aged. You summer.
Yeah. You know, and there's some towns like this in the Hudson Valley and so on and so forth. And like those places are nice, but like, they're nice specifically because like rich people making money elsewhere, like come to visit them, mm-hmm. which is different from like a organically thriving small town, which just needs some kind of local, you know, industry,
yeah.
right, to be powering it. Only so many places can be like visited by tourists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not like a viable economic model for Nebraska. You know, they're too far from other big cities. Mm-hmm. There's like too many other small towns between you and Los Angeles. And so it's like kind of easy for like intellectuals in big coastal cities mm-hmm. to be like, maybe like all of rural America should be like the really nice place I want to vacation. But like that doesn't actually make sense, right? And that's why like the actual elected officials from those places don't have, like, they don't have, like, my views about politics, but they also don't have
yes.
that kind of left communitarian opinion. Mm-hmm. They're just always trying to be like, we need more natural resource extraction mm-hmm. because that's, like, what people do for money.
Yeah. Well, always our last and final question. What's an argument you've heard recently that you disagreed with? This can be anything from an article you read or a book you read recently or parenting or relationship advice or a tweet or a TV show. What do you got?
I like the Big Picture podcast. I like the Ringer podcast network mm-hmm. A lot. The claim that The Social Network is the best movie of the 21st century so far. I disagree with this. So it just like keeps bothering me like days and days later.
Do you think they did it just to create the discourse?
No.
Really?
No. And I think it writes to my friend is like, I love movies, but like I'm a political pundit, mm-hmm. you know, first and foremost. And it just like bugs me mm-hmm. that this like true story about Mark Zuckerberg like significantly like falsifies aspects of his life, because he's obviously one of the signature figures of mm-hmm. our time, and to critically examine him and his work seems like an important sort of valid task, but to like make stuff up about his relationships with women and that's role in his company, like to me that's like a real disservice, even though like I enjoy the movie.
I thought you were going to complain about the making some of his roommates seem like the good guys and him the bad guy in like a financial sense.
I mean,
you're complaining about the woman thing. I thought it was just like that's a device. It's like a literary device, right?
I know.
What's wrong with that?
Well, but it's like, because it's like the central literary device of the thing. But like, he's married to the girlfriend he met when he was a freshman. That's like not the story of Facebook at all. And, you know.
But it's like an instrument to like call him an asshole. Like, I don't think it's really about him being a misogynist, right? Like, that's not really that relevant. It's that he's an elitist asshole. And like, he's like, you went to BU. So like, you went to study. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, why would this bother you?
I mean, because like, I think
you're like a literal person.
Well, but I think the fact that it's not true, it's like, it's important because like, I actually think that like Facebook's products mm-hmm. have had a significant deleterious impact mm-hmm. on humanity in a way that like gives me pause. And it's like sort of important to understand like how and why that happened. But like, it didn't happen the way that they say it happened.
This is true.
And
I just don't really think people are getting like biographical information from the social network. Like they're not like I'm, let me learn about the world.
I mean, I agree that they're, and listen, I would not have like come out in you know, whatever month it is,
yeah.
January 2026, be like, The Social Network that came out many years ago is trash. Cause that's not even how I feel about it. But it's just like, when it was elevated, like the best
yeah.
is like a really high bar.
Wait, what's your movie? Top 21st century.
I think There Will Be Blood.
That's a good pick.
Which, you know, like conveniently does mm-hmm. not like claim to be the true story of an individual oil baron. It's like representative of certain like tropes and ideas and
thoughts. So if they hadn't said Mark Zuckerberg and it was said at Yale, you'd be totally fine.
I love it. No, I don't know. But you know, like Citizen Kane is like about Hearst, but like it's not about Hearst. It's a fictional story. Mm-hmm. It's inspired, you know? And like, I think that's how we do literature. If you want to tell a true story, make it accurate.
Well, Matt Iglesias, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.